You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Time now to pick up on some of the religious currents in the world's press over the past week or so. And we're joined this evening by Scott Stevens, religion and ethics editor for ABC Online. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, John. It's good to be with you.
And we really should point people to our religion and ethics website as being one of the best, I think we can say this without being accused of bias, one of the best religion websites available in the world today.
Well, John, I'm not going to disagree with you there. I would fully agree with that assessment. And I think, I mean, if there's one very fine thing to commend it, we really do try to go for primary sources. So instead of, you know, interpreted, abbreviated versions of this or that speech from the Pope, we really try to go for the big figures, the big players, and try to present what they're saying in a kind of fullness that I think is lacking elsewhere.
Well, we've just come out of a discussion on the recent statement by the Pontifical Council on economics and the global financial crisis. This is also being picked up more widely. I noticed that Rowan Williams has got into this one.
He certainly has, which is incredibly interesting. If I can just give a little bit of background before launching into what the Archbishop has said, I mean, there is a growing feeling, especially among the media and the commentariat in the UK, that the source of some genuinely original ideas concerning the relationship between the economy and society, civil society itself, there's a growing sense that the best ideas are actually coming from religious commentators, and specifically from those who are kind of influenced by a Catholic form of economics. So you could point to somebody like Philip Blond with the think tank Res Publica. You could point to somebody like Morris Glasman, who, even though he himself is not Catholic but rather Jewish, he's very formed by many of the same influences, and even somebody like John Milbank, who of course is a longstanding and dear friend of Rowan Williams. So there's this interesting idea that the traditional way in which economics and politics has been configured in the West, that's kind of run its course. It's almost, you know, run onto dry ground, which is at the heart of our current economic predicament, and that the real debate at the moment is about not how government regulation versus the economy interact, but rather how the economy can be placed back in the service of civil society itself. And I think this is where your discussion about the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace document really strikes the proper balance. Yes, it is about government regulation, but you're absolutely right. It's fundamentally about how to place the economy, rather than elevating it as a kind of idol, how to reconfigure the economy so that it serves the needs of civil society.
It's been played out gloriously, of course, in the UK this week with the Occupy movement and St Paul's Cathedral, where we've seen the, if not the foundations, certainly the surface of the cathedral shaken considerably by the resignation of two of the cathedral's most significant figures in the face of the Occupy London protests. And their resignation comes over profound philosophical issues. It's really quite extraordinary.
Absolutely. Look, this is remarkable. And, you know, when you've got these seismic events happening in London, I must confess it's difficult for me to conceal a smirk when I look at these rather low-grade protests happening in Brisbane and Sydney and Melbourne. I don't think the folk here have really gotten the enormity of both the wealth gap and discrepancy overseas, but also philosophically what's at heart. So what's essentially happened is that just on 3 weeks ago, a whole crew of protesters, or a rather small group, there would be several hundred, but not much more than that, wanted to try to occupy the space immediately outside the London Stock Exchange. But because that space is owned and fully regulated by the Corporation of the City of London, now I think that's a very important designation to evoke here, because we tend not to realize that central area of London is in fact a kind of anomalous corporation with its own structure, its own international status.
Yes, this goes back to the days of the medieval guilds and even before that, back really to the foundation of the city, doesn't it? Well, the modern foundation of the city.
That's exactly right. And so there's this legal and financial gap, if you like, between the corporation of the City of London on the one hand and the wider London metropolis, and then beyond that, the UK itself. And so, you know, there has been this ongoing issue that many philosophers and theologians and others have been pointing to for some time, that the corporation of the City of London belongs to the realm of international finance. And it, if you like, it's decoupled itself from the well-being of the people around it.
Yes, the word the city has come to, in the last 30 years, to have a very specific meaning.
Absolutely right. And so little did these protesters know that in occupying this space, they were camping themselves out on a kind of fault line that runs through the nation itself. So, you know, understandably,
St. Paul's Cathedral itself is within the boundaries of the city, the corporation. So St. Paul's becomes the center of the fault in a way.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the legal status of St. Paul's itself is also a rather complex matter. A part of St. Paul's belongs to the City of London, would you believe? And part of it actually has its own autonomous status.
So, other thing we should say here, for those interested in these arcane little bits and pieces, is that St. Paul's is built right next to or adjacent to or on the site of St. Paul's Cross, which has been a historic meeting place for the citizens of London back pre the time of William the Conqueror. In fact, it was there that the Conqueror met the citizens of London to work out the sort of accommodation.
Almost exactly a millennia ago. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary. So there was this great symbolic resonance of the people moving themselves from outside of the London Stock Exchange to the steps of St. Paul's. And this is what began the great kerfuffle within St. Paul's itself. On the one hand, the dean of the cathedral began supporting quite vocally and publicly moves to expel the protesters along two grounds. One, and it's almost embarrassing to say this, but you know, one was purely tourist. That, you know, the one of the fundamental mechanisms of a cathedral in a place like London today is actually to welcome visitors and to sort of generate a certain amount of income. And then the other is the rather stupider grounds of occupational health and safety. So they literally closed the cathedral.
First time since the Second World War.
Precisely right. Now, the
as a tourist myself, one has to say, I have an instinct that would say, well, what are these occupiers doing, blocking up the cathedral and preventing the normal functioning of a cathedral? Sure, the dean and chapter have a responsibility to keep this place open to the public. That's their line, and it's a line which would resonate, surely.
That's right. But you see, the head of the chapter of the cathedral then saw any moves to expel the protesters as the church engaging in a form of coercion and violence against the citizenry. And that then led to his resignation.
Because it goes back to an older vision of the church's sanctuary in a way.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So all the while, dear Rowan Williams, who most of us who know his work would have a sense of what his own convictions about what's going on here might be, but he's been strangely silent through the process. I think precisely to give a degree of political cover to the dean of the cathedral. Anything that he might say would leave the dean of the cathedral quite badly exposed, but also the Bishop of London, Richard Chartres. It would leave him in a very sort of strange position as well.
We had four people linked in this. We had two at the cathedral, then we had the Bishop of London and Rowan Williams. Mm. The two at the cathedral, one was the dean, and the other, sort of very well known for those who take notice of these things in London, speaks quite popularly on social issues.
That's right.
His position is known as what? It's the sort of something Chancellor of the Cathedral, wasn't it? Sort of another arcane title. But it amounted to a standoff between the two of those, really over foundational issues.
That's exactly right. What is the church? What does the church stand for in the City of London? Now, if you sort of imagine this as a kind of ground war happening and the Archbishop of Canterbury remaining, I think, strategically silent, now imagine, you know, the big B-20 bomber, John Milbank, who's one of the most influential but also pugilistic theologians in England today. Imagine him dropping this enormous bomb on the entire situation where he castigates, almost eviscerates what he calls the upper echelons of the Anglican hierarchy for so participating in the blind and sham rituals of the pursuit of greed in the City of London that they themselves have become blind to the tremendous symbolic resonance, both of St. Paul's in its position within the City of London, but also the necessary protection that ought to be offered to these protesters. And, you know, his description, you can actually read his full statement on the ABC Religion and Ethics website, he describes the church as being sclerotic in its handling and utterly blind in its failure to recognize the tremendous symbolic resonance of what's happening here. And he basically calls on Rowan Williams, for God's sake, Rowan, you've got to say something about this. And then it was the following day that Rowan came out and was very, very politic, quite reserved in what he was saying. He was saying, you know, these are, in fact, immensely complex issues. If it seems as though the Anglican Church isn't satisfying everybody, maybe it's because the issues themselves are immensely complex. But then what he ends up doing, which was quite extraordinary, is then he points the finger back to the protesters themselves. And he says, yes, there are idols of finance here that ought to be toppled, but you have to focus what you are demanding. You need to bring some clarity to what you want a more civil form of economic behavior to look like. And it's there that he points to the Pontifical Council statement, which surprised and delighted many of us.
It is very interesting that, and this goes back to your comment earlier, that many people are beginning to look back towards informed statements on society and economics that have been developed over the past century, and more they're finding that the church has said them. Well, of course, if you go back to 1891, you have the great statement on Catholic social teaching, Rerum Novarum, which
That's
begins
right.
a tradition which has consistent and coherent development right through even into the pontificates of John Paul II and now Benedict XVI. And one of the interesting things pointing to this is another finding that it's the Catholics who seem to have preserved a more communitarian view of the way the world should work than the Calvinistic strand of Protestantism.
That's exactly right. Who would have imagined that dear old Max Weber was right, that somehow capitalism and Protestantism are hand in glove? Look, this was – and I think the observation you're making here, John, is exactly right. And I think one of the reasons that the Catholic Church has been able to retain a kind of sharp and radical edge over the last century and a bit is because it's never seen itself as falling down on either the progressive or the conservative sides of politics, neither left nor right. And this is something that both Pope Paul VI and then especially John Paul II and now reaffirmed by Benedict XVI, they've always talked about Catholic social teaching as almost slicing diagonally across the divide, saying critical words to both. But there's a fascinating – I was quite overjoyed to read a working paper that was produced by the European Central Bank. I mean, can you imagine the central banks produce – you know, pieces of substantial research like this, saying that whereas Protestants tend to not just work longer and not just sort of, you know, participate far more actively within the kind of rat race of European capitalism, but they do tend to hoard and they do tend to be far less civil in their understandings of what the economy is for, whereas Catholics simply tend to have a much more civil approach. Now, but it's the theological reason for this, and they're gesturing at this in the European Central Bank working paper, but I don't think they got it exactly right. There is a fundamental theological gap here, I think, between Protestants and Catholics. And here there's much more commonality between Catholics and Judaism. That there's the idea that God has given this world more than enough, that the world, if you like, is almost infused with this kind of ongoing sacrament of grace and gratuity, so that in giving, one doesn't run out, but one rather receives more. Whereas there's this constant fear among Protestants, is there not, that, you know, if I share, then what I lose might in fact be taken away from me.
It's also about the Catholic Church, or the Catholic, and going back, as you say, into the Jewish tradition, the sense that God is a function of the community or a product or is essentially grounded in the community, whereas in the Protestant sense, God is found in individual salvation.
Very much so. And also this is where Protestants represent, it seems, and let me just, you know, say I'm not a Catholic here, but Protestants do also represent a kind of perversion of the notion of Catholic virtue, whereas the virtue is so internalized that it becomes a kind of sanctification rather than virtue as a mechanism of behavior, where what you do directly embodies this kind of sanctification that you might that you might hold.
But sanctification is a state of the self rather than an act of doing.
Yeah, precisely right.
It also plays out, of course, in the current debates across the United States. I mean, one does not know how this pontifical statement is going to be received in the United States. I can imagine a fair amount of tension among some Catholic circles where this sense of religion is very, very strongly tied to a sense of the individual and a sense of the individual that is, strangely, a construct of the Enlightenment. It is not a construct of religion.
That's exactly right. Look, there, I think there are two important points to make about this. Firstly, there is a great deal of suspicion among many right-leaning Catholics in the United States towards the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. Many of them see that council as being a kind of left-wing rabble within the Vatican. And there's one very prominent commentator who even severely and surprisingly criticized the Pope's last social encyclical, Charity and Truth, for exhibiting too much covert influence from the Pontifical Council. So I think you're right. There is going to be a degree of suspicion towards it. And the other point that you're making about capitalism, Christianity, and the individual, I think you're exactly right. You're certainly historically correct. But there are interesting changes afoot. I would direct our listeners to extraordinary research that's been carried out over the last 10 years by a North American sociologist and anthropologist named Marcia Pally. She's just got a book on the new evangelicals coming out in the next couple months, where she's been documenting the kind of changing face of North American evangelical Christianity, which continues to be pro-life, so continues to be sort of anti-abortion, and yet it's more pro-gay marriage, it's pro-immigration, it's anti-market and anti-consumerist. It tends to be quite radical in its communitarianism and its emphasis on local society and civility, and it tends to be sort of typically American in its great hostility towards big government and towards state power itself.
This is the influence of the Mennonite strand, with through people like Ron Sider, then coming through to evangelicals like Jim Wallis and the Sojourners and Tony Campolo and his I guess it's almost black influenced evangelicalism.
Very much, and yet there are some other interesting streams that are happening here as well. You've got the great revival of the Catholic and Orthodox traditions that are taking place among some Protestants. I'm thinking of the likes of somebody like Stanley Hauerwas at Duke University, and then bringing that together with the Mennonite influence. You're exactly right. To create this kind of strange pacifist, nonviolent activism along with forms of progressive social policy, along with the traditional kind of sweet spots of North American evangelicalism. It's very interesting. And yet, John, what it does marry nicely with is the North American influence on locality and local community as always more important than either state government or even national identity.
It's making life very difficult for the Republican Party, as its rump tends to be tied back to a sort of white Protestant Tea Party version of Christianity, which is not reflective of the trends you're talking about.
That's exactly right. Although the trends that we're talking about, they are cognate with the Tea Party. They stem in many ways from the same regard, for the same importance that locality and local community has over and against government. But, I mean, we should remember, for instance, that one of the central figures of this new evangelical movement is somebody like Rick Warren, who Barack Obama got to deliver the inauguration prayer. So, you know, you're exactly right. The changing face of North American evangelicalism and this constant hackneyed appeal of these far right-wing Republican candidates back to this, you know, ever-shrinking but also ever more extreme sort of Protestant sort of fundamentalist base, it really is redrawing, I think, the map of North American politics. And it's also effectively leaving many, many North American voters, North American evangelical voters, with no candidate. And what many commentators are predicting is that the coming election will in fact have one of the lowest turnouts since the election of Jimmy Carter in the late 70s.
More to come on that one. We've only got a minute or so left, Scott. I just want to touch on one other thing. In a couple of minutes' time, we're going to be talking with Fuzz Kitto, who has been in Egypt throughout the dreadful month where many of the Copts felt themselves under direct threat from whatever politics is going to emerge out of Egypt. There is a debate about the way the Arab Spring is going. We've got a minute or so left, and I know you've got some observations on this from your experience in the website and the articles you've been getting.
Just very simply, there is a massive divide that few of us have recognized within the Arab world at the moment. The one center would be around Al-Azhar University there in Cairo, which is an extraordinary site of learning and also reform within Islam, within Muslim theology. On the other side of this divide is what Khaled Abu al-Fadl, who's a great Muslim intellectual, what he describes as this burgeoning world of supremacist Puritanism, which is fundamentally a lay movement, but also a deeply ignorant movement about the traditions of Islam itself, someone like Osama bin Laden, but also Ahmadinejad. Both of these represent, if you like, the worst extremes of precisely that tradition. So I think there's this growing gap between this sort of lay populist supremacist movement that most of us know under the name of Islamicist or, you know, Islamic fundamentalist, and this extraordinary group of Muslim intellectuals, many of whom actually gathered with Pope Benedict recently at Assisi. So I think, you know, this is something to watch. And it's also interesting that many of the protesters that were involved at Tahrir Square, many of them exhibited time and time again a great devotion to the Al-Azhar school of Islam rather than this sort of Islamicist wing. So I think this is interesting to be following.
Scott Stevens, editor of the ABC's Religion and Ethics website. Scott, we've run out of time. So much to talk about, so little time to do it. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
We hope to talk to you again soon.
Great. Thanks, John.